This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Since this program began on September 17th, you, our listeners, have generously shared your thoughts and your voices with all of us through your radio diaries. These diaries have brought insight and urgent emotions to our hours and helped us all see beyond the news. And they serve to document this remarkable, tragic, historic time. Tonight, as we begin a new year, we're taking an hour to listen back to your voices, to remember where we were, what we were thinking, and what we were feeling as the past three incredible months unfolded. In this section, stories of looking homeward. On the morning of September 12th, a children's book author living in San Francisco wrote an email that would soon find its way around the world and lead its author to brief but international prominence. Tamim Ansari's impassioned open letter to the powers that eventually brought a bombing campaign to his home country of Afghanistan called for thoughtful restraint in the search for justice and vengeance. Before his appearance on Oprah and before his letter was quoted in that special edition of The West Wing, Tamim Ansari read his letter as a radio diary.
Yesterday, I heard a lot of talk about bombing Afghanistan back to the Stone Age. One radio talk show host allowed that this would mean killing innocent people, people who had nothing to do with this atrocity, but, quote, "We're at war, we have to accept collateral damage," unquote. And he asked, "What else can we do? What is your suggestion?" Minutes later, I heard a TV pundit discussing whether we, quote, "have the belly to do what must be done," unquote. And I thought about these issues especially hard because I am from Afghanistan, and even though I've lived here for 35 years, I've never lost track of what's been going on over there. So I want to share a few thoughts with anyone who will listen. I speak as one who hates the Taliban and Osama bin Laden. There is no doubt in my mind that these people were responsible for the atrocity in New York. I fervently wish to see those monsters punished. But the Taliban and bin Laden are not Afghanistan. They're not even the government of Afghanistan. The Taliban are a cult of ignorant psychotics who captured Afghanistan in 1997 and have been holding the country in bondage ever since. Bin Laden is a political criminal with a master plan. When you think Taliban, think Nazis. When you think bin Laden, think Hitler. And when you think, quote, "the people of Afghanistan," unquote, think the Jews in the concentration camps. It's not only that the Afghan people had nothing to do with this atrocity. They were the first victims of the perpetrators. They would love for someone to eliminate the Taliban and clear out the rat's nest of international thugs holed up in their country. I guarantee it. Some say if that's the case, why don't the Afghans rise up and overthrow the Taliban themselves? The answer is they're starved, exhausted, damaged, and incapacitated. A few years ago, a credible aid organization, the D.C.-based Help the Afghan Children, estimated that there are 500,000 disabled orphans in Afghanistan, a country with no economy, no food. Millions of Afghans are widows of the approximately 2 million men killed during the war with the Soviets. And the Taliban has been executing these women for being women and have buried some of their opponents alive in mass graves. The soil of Afghanistan is littered with landmines, and almost all the farms have been destroyed. The Afghan people have tried to overthrow the Taliban. They haven't been able to. We come now to the question of bombing Afghanistan back to the Stone Age. Trouble with that scheme is it's already been done. The Soviets took care of it. Make the Afghans suffer? They're already suffering. Level their houses? Done. Turn their schools into piles of rubble? Done. Eradicate their hospitals? Done. Destroy their infrastructure? There is no infrastructure. Cut them off from medicine and health care? Too late. Someone already did all that. New bombs would only plow up the rubble of earlier bombs. Would they at least get the Taliban? Not likely. In today's Afghanistan, only the Taliban eat, only they have the means to move around. They'd slip away and hide. Maybe the bombs would get some of those disabled orphans. They don't move too fast. They don't even have wheelchairs. Let me now speak with true fear and trembling. The only way to get bin Laden is to go in there with ground troops. Americans will die in a land war to get bin Laden. And not just because some Americans would die fighting their way through Afghanistan to bin Laden's hideout. It's much bigger than that, folks. To get any troops to Afghanistan, we'd have to go through Pakistan. Would they let us? Not likely. The conquest of Pakistan would have to be first. Will other Muslim nations just stand by? You see where I'm going. The invasion approach is a flirtation with global war between Islam and the West. And that is bin Laden's program. That's exactly what he wants and why he did this thing. Read his speeches and statements. It's all right there. At the moment, of course, Islam as such does not exist. There are Muslims and there are Muslim countries, but no such political entity as Islam. Bin Laden believes that if he can get a war started, he can constitute this entity and he'd be running it. He really believes Islam would beat the West. It might seem ridiculous, but he figures if he can polarize the world into Islam and the West, he's got a billion soldiers. If the West wreaks a Holocaust in Muslim lands, that's a billion people with nothing left to lose. Even better from bin Laden's point of view. He's probably wrong about winning. In the end, the West would probably overcome, whatever that would mean in such a war. But the war would last for years, and millions would die, not just theirs, but ours. Who has the belly for that? Bin Laden, yes, but anyone else?
Tamim Ansari lives in San Francisco. While Afghans living abroad were all too familiar with the images of destruction that emanate from news reports from their home country, for most Americans, the news and pictures that came out of New York, Pennsylvania, and Washington were shocking. Lila Gerstein is a New Yorker living in Los Angeles. In this radio diary, she speaks of watching her hometown burn from 3,000 miles away.
I watch the news. I watch the news a lot. My relationship with Peter Jennings is bordering on the obscene, but I can't stop. My eyes thirsty for pictures of my town and my people, desperate to try to understand what it could possibly be like there now. I don't know this New York. I wasn't there on Tuesday. I watched my hometown undergo the worst, most horrifying attack in American history while paralyzed on my couch in West Hollywood, powerless to do anything but hit redial for 6 hours as I frantically tried to get in touch with my family and friends in Manhattan. Until last Tuesday, I was working on a novel about the existential crises of three post-Ivy League Manhattan 20-somethings. How ridiculous, how embarrassing, how utterly outdated it seems now. Suddenly, everything besides death and love is pointless. My novel so trivial it seems disgusting, my writing so meaningless it seems a joke. A novel about chicly dressed downtown Cosmo drinkers could only be a period piece now. Things in L.A. just don't seem very important anymore. Nothing other than this seems important at all. And knowing that, it's very hard to be in California. Although I have resided here a year and a half now, it is not my home. But is New York? It is no longer the city in which I was born and bred, had my first kiss, my first job, my first apartment. It is no longer the New York where I was a child and became an adult. It is no longer the New York which is so closely tied to my identity. Everything and everyone is different. My mother tells me even her dogs are altered, hiding under the bed, not playful, not hungry. The existential angst of the 20-somethings I write about, drawn from my own life and the lives of my New York friends, is extinct like our complacency. What is existential angst when you've just had to fight for your very existence? Abby at jury duty downtown witnessed people leaping to their deaths yards in front of her face, only to discover 9 hours later the disappearance of an ex-boyfriend. Stacy, who recently moved with her boyfriend Peter to an apartment a block and a half from Ground Zero, almost died as the towers came down, keeping seconds ahead of the smoke and debris until she reached safety on a crosstown bus. Her building will probably be condemned, but she has never felt more fortunate. Jill and Emily watched in horror from their roof in Soho as the second airplane hit and our skyline crumbled. Megan speaks of leaving her office in Midtown to head home in a sea of smoke and hysteria, of looking south and seeing nothing where the towers once stood. Everyone knows someone who has died, someone they loved or once loved or a loved one loved who is now gone, and the news keeps trickling in. The father of a Hebrew school classmate, a neighbor, a family friend. Late Thursday night, I discovered that Raina, a friend of mine from college who I have, for the silly, irresponsible reasons that people do, fallen out of touch with, lost her husband. She is 27 years old. I don't know if I can still consider myself a New Yorker anymore. Maybe I will be just as much a stranger there as I am here. I haven't been through what they've been through. I haven't had smoke sting my eyes and fear creep in my veins. I haven't had to show ID to go to my apartment or been rendered homeless by an attack. I haven't jumped every time I've heard an airplane or had to evacuate my building. I haven't been widowed at 27. But next week I am flying home, this time maybe for good. I don't know if I will walk into a town I recognize at all. I just know I need to be there. I need to understand what downtown must look like, what the smoke must smell like, what the F-16s flying overhead must sound like. I need to know what it means to be a New Yorker now, to have suffered the insufferable, to have risen bereaved but proud and united and hopeful. I need to see my grandparents who live in Chelsea and who are trying to maintain their cheeriness. They tell me to stop calling so much, constantly reassuring me that they are fine. Grandma brags that Grandpa Jack has been making hundreds of thousands of sandwiches for the volunteers. But I recognize that the gravelly sound I hear in her voice is the result of inhaling smoke for the last week. Is there anything more important than being with her now? Everything I was worried about, cared about, wanted, is suddenly overpowered by the driving need to be with those I love, to rally around the city that has rallied around itself.
Lila Gerstein lives in Los Angeles. In the weeks that followed the attacks, many Americans felt compelled to travel to New York to see the devastation firsthand and pay tribute to the victims. Ann Butler Rice lived in New York for several years. When she returned to the city after the attacks, she found it difficult to navigate in a changed landscape.
I was born and raised in Kansas, but for the last 11 years, I have been a New Yorker. My husband is a New Yorker. My neighbors were New Yorkers. My friends are New Yorkers. My family moved in June to Boston, and I've been missing New York. I yearned for the city long before September 11th, but its call has been so much louder in the weeks since. Last weekend, I packed up my husband and toddler to make our pilgrimage. As I sat in my mother-in-law's Brooklyn Heights brownstone on the promenade, I had a clear and expansive view of Lower Manhattan. From there, I've gazed countless hours across the East River to the shadowy giants speckled with random clusters of windows lit against the dark, like constellations in the night sky. They were always there, providing a familiar urban landscape as stunning as any mountain range or field of wheat. As we made our way into the city across the Whitestone Bridge and through Queens on the BQE, we traveled the length of Manhattan. I could easily locate Midtown, the Empire State Building, dressed in red, white, and blue, and the Chrysler Building, elegant as ever. They were markers guiding my path. I searched the horizon for Lower Manhattan. It was then that my disorientation began. When I looked across the river from the promenade, the disorientation strengthened. As I stood at Ground Zero, facing west across Liberty Street from Broadway, my disorientation was complete. The beacons that formed my compass in this city wilderness were gone. They are gone. I am trying to negotiate this disorientation. I need to be here to get my bearings, make contact with the beloved place and people here. It is part of my personal recovery plan. I need a means of processing the enormity of this loss and to find my direction in these bewildering days. You are here, says the subway map at Wall Street, but what I see is a hole. At night, it is literally that, a faintly luminous space peering out from between neighboring skyscrapers, lit for the crews working furiously to clean it, bandage it, heal it like an open wound. Now, more than a month after the wound was inflicted and 2 days after our arrival, I see the first signs of recovery where the emptiness screamed before. I allow myself to see smiles, to hear laughter, and to walk barefoot in the lush grass in Battery Park, and to nod to the Statue of Liberty holding her torch up for the weary masses. During my pilgrimage, I saw a city resolute in its determination to heal, to defeat its intimidator, to prove its strength. I was able to confront the emptiness in myself and take a long look at the map of my soul. My Manhattan-born husband was never angrier with me than when I accused him of not being able to find his way somewhere in the city. New Yorkers pride themselves on their navigational skills. The disorientation that they must be feeling right now, the physical and psychological sensation of being lost, of loss itself, appears to be diminishing. It is bound to be a long and painful recovery, but it has begun. I know New Yorkers will find their way and themselves through this maze of despair and fear. They need only get hold of a new map and find the place that says, you are here.
Ann Butler Rice lives in Belmont, Massachusetts. Coming up, more radio diaries from the last 3 months. We'd like to hear your stories. Send submissions for future radio diaries by email to special@wbur.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. Tonight, we're listening back to some of the radio diaries that you, our listeners, have shared with us since our program started on September 17th. For some Americans, the destruction of the World Trade Center was all too familiar. Julie Delcour covered the Oklahoma City bombing case for the Tulsa World, from the destruction of the Murrah Federal Building in 1995 through the execution of Timothy McVeigh in June.
I had been watching coverage of what had happened in New York for hours when I heard a commentator finally say it. The worst terrorist attack on American soil. The designation stunned me, not because it is hard to believe, but because for 6.5 years and 1,000 stories, I've used the same words to describe what happened in Oklahoma City. Now I wondered what I would do when I wrote the next story. What would I say? That the Oklahoma City bombing was the second deadliest terrorist attack on American soil? There is a horrible symmetry to the two events, but on the scales of horror, I know that Oklahoma's most senseless tragedy somehow is now diminished in history. We have become prologue to a greater, more shocking chapter of horror. We lost 168 people that day. I try to imagine what the death toll will be in New York and at the Pentagon. I know that almost none of those missing will be found alive. The last person taken out of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building was pulled out of the night of the bombing. To free Brandy Liggins, a doctor working in a black cave of rubble with only inches to maneuver, sawed her leg off with a pocket knife. I do not know which is worse, to watch coverage not knowing what will come next, as most of the public is doing, or to know exactly what will come next. I can see so clearly all the steps ahead, except, of course, for the end. There is no end to a story like this. As I watched the New York coverage, I heard names on television that I had not thought of for years. Incredibly, Ray Downey, the fire department of New York City's top expert on collapsed disasters, is dead. He was killed when a World Trade Center tower collapsed, crushing him under the rubble. Downey had come to Oklahoma as part of a FEMA team. He worked for weeks here, guiding rescue and recovery operations. As I watched the coverage the night of the tragedy, I wondered when that moment would come when Mayor Giuliani would announce that the status of the mission had switched from rescue to recovery. When would they tell all those people at the armory with their pictures and mementos of the missing that the very most they could expect was a body, or would they even get that? On a morning a few days after the terrorist attacks, I walked through my garage, where I keep the boxes of stories and transcripts and notes and photographs from the biggest, most terrible story I have covered in 28 years of newspaper reporting. There are at least 36 boxes. I have tried to bring myself to take the boxes down to the Tulsa World and put them in the basement, but I don't know if I'll ever be able to put that part of my life in storage. I dug through one of the boxes to find a particular witness's testimony from the opening day in the 1997 McVeigh trial. I know the date because I have looked at this testimony 100 times. The day I heard the testimony, I finally understood what it really meant for those who survived it and lost someone in it. I find the testimony of Helena Garrett, a young single mother who lost her toddler in the blast. I want to read her words because for days I've been unable to accept how this horror could possibly happen again. She was working in the Journal Record Building on the morning of the blast. She had just arrived at work after dropping off her 16-month-old son, Tevin, at the daycare in the Murrah. She heard an explosion and debris started to fall around her. She and a friend, holding on to each other, literally felt their way out of the dark, damaged building. When Helena Garrett saw the face of the Murrah, she started to run toward it. When she reached the building, she tried to climb a pile of rubble, only to be pulled down by a police officer who told her it was too dangerous. She ran to the back side of the building, which was relatively undamaged, and climbed up to the plaza level, to a playground for the children. By then, rescuers were bringing out little bodies, 4 to a stretcher, and wrapping them in white sheets. "I didn't see Tevin," Garrett recalled. "And I started crying, and I was screaming. I said, 'Please don't lay our babies on the glass. We don't want our babies on the glass.' And this man left and came back with this big type of broom, and he swept the glass for me, and he swept the glass and got it away from the babies." Helena Garrett stayed with the children that terrible morning, hoping they would bring Tevin out alive. "I wouldn't leave the babies," she said. "They didn't have anybody else up there that knew them. I stayed right there by Colton and the larger baby that was by my feet, and a lady came, a nurse. She was in a uniform, and she started tagging our babies, and right then I realized they were all dead." I have thought many times about Helena Garrett, who gave that testimony in a courtroom not 20 feet from the man who killed her child. I have thought about a remark made by Prosecutor Beth Wilkinson in the closing arguments of Timothy McVeigh's trial. Wilkinson had asked the jurors, "What in the world did Tevin Garrett have to do with Waco?" Now I wonder what all those thousands of innocent victims in New York had to do with the real or imaginary grudges of madmen. I sat there in the garage holding the testimony. Next to me was a box labeled McVeigh's Execution. The box contained the end of the story for the second deadliest terrorist attack on American soil. I thought about New York and all the hundreds of Helena Garretts waiting at the armory, and I knew that the story was just beginning.
Julie Delcor lives in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Growing up in a farming community in rural Vermont, Chris Kimball was very familiar with the notion that catastrophe could strike and permanently change lives at any moment. In this radio diary, he speaks of how the tragedy of September 11th changed the rhythms of rural life.
Since September 11th, I've thought a lot about disaster. In Vermont, where I grew up and now spend summers and weekends, I'm used to disaster in many forms, an overturned tractor, a barn fire, or a bucking chainsaw. And over time, I've learned to take precautions. I always park my pickup facing home when logging in the woods. I don't change gears on a loaded tractor when going downhill. And I don't stack green hay in a barn, since it can spontaneously burst into flames. I've met locals with one arm, parents who have lost children in hay accidents, and met more than one mill worker down at Miles Lumber, who's at least one finger short. One of my most vivid memories as a child was watching Colonel Vaughn's barn burn from the top of Swearing Hill. At first, it looked like a small brush fire, and then I realized that it was a day I would never forget, the smoke curling up into the sky, dark and sinister, as if left by an invading army. But last spring, disaster took a more personal turn. Charlie Bentley, the farmer who hired me during summers back in the 60s to pitch hay and milk cows, was injured in a serious tractor accident. Charlie was working under a disc harrow, and when the tractor started up, the harrow dropped suddenly and caught him by the neck. He was dragged through the field face down until the tractor could be stopped. He survived. Vermont farmers are hardy folk. But as my family's last living connection to a life which is long gone from Vermont's Green Mountains, we were all shaken. Within days, a neighbor organized a pancake breakfast fundraiser. I cooked 35 pounds of homemade sausage. Others made vats of pancake batter. The country store sent along gallons of orange juice, and locals donated items for a silent auction. On a crisp spring morning in June, 250 kids, farmers, carpenters, plumbers, truckers, and dairymen raised over $10,000. Not much by city standards, but an impressive sum for a town that has fewer residents that would fit into the Methodist Church. The rest of the summer never regained its rhythm, so my wife and I decided to hold a covered dish supper over Labor Day weekend. Neighbors brought molasses, lace, baked beans, ambrosia, three-bean salad, macaroni, chili casserole, vegetable lasagna, honey cake, and cherry pie, along with their folding lawn chairs. We stacked bales of hay for a table, boiled 150 ears of Silver King and Bodacious corn, and served up 60 pounds of barbecued beef. As night came, we turned on the strings of construction lights hanging from the trees, and the kids scattered into the nearby cornfield, playing hide-and-seek. Charlie Bentley showed up and did his part, tucking into seconds, casting an eager eye towards the softer, more brightly colored desserts. Everything finally seemed back to normal on that evening as we sat together in tattered lawn chairs, drawn in a circle under an ancient maple tree, listening to a distant thunderstorm that was slowly moving up the valley. A column of boys paraded smartly around the gathering with sticks held stiffly over narrow shoulders. Lightning flashed in the distance like approaching artillery, and groups of families slowly dissolved into the night, enveloped by pear trees and darkness. In the country, families are not a lifestyle. They are instead the bedrock, the foundation, the place we return to each night to find a hot supper and a warm fire. Families are chicken and biscuit dinners at the fire station, Friday night football, homecoming day, and a hot Sunday afternoon in August, the rescue squad, and the promise of a plate at the table for unexpected guests. It's politics and coffee at the country store, sitting around a boiling evaporator in March, drinking Genesee and telling stories that are sometimes true. Family life is a continuum, a force that absorbs disasters and tragedies. It is always there when you need it, even when you start up the pickup and head out of town, never to return. Just then, the distant thunder was upon us, and I awoke from thoughts of the coming storm by the sound of our children in the cornfield. In our nation's darkest hour, they called out from the heart of America, reminding us that every small town is a great nation, and each child is a nation unto himself.
Chris Kimball lives in Boston and Vermont. Poet and performance artist Emily XYZ has lived and worked in New York for 20 years. She was in Chicago when the attacks occurred, but returned a few days later to a more somber, silent, and kinder city than she had ever known.
In Hinduism, there is such a thing as sacred ash, which is striped across the foreheads of Brahmins and spiritual seekers. In Catholicism also, there is sacred ash, which comes in the form of a little cross drawn on your forehead by a priest's thumb on Ash Wednesday. They used to say, "Remember, man, that thou art dust, and into dust thou shalt return." There is secular ash, too, like what remains in the barbecue grill after a summer cookout, or what's left after leaf piles burn in the fall, in the few towns where this is still allowed. And then there is the ash that never should have been, that everyone wishes would reverse pulverize, reorganize its particles, and become again the thing it once was. This is the category of ash into which the World Trade Center falls. At Park Row and Ann Street, right across from City Hall, one of the most ominous views, Old St. Paul's Chapel, completely undamaged. Behind that, the Woolworth Building, once the world's tallest, now seeming quite tall again, but dark. No electricity in this part of town, save that provided by huge generators to power big work lights. And behind the Woolworth Building, the constant, swirling, steamy, billowing white smoke, lit up by the work lights, like a movie running against the blue-black sky. At Church and Chambers, another view of smoke and light, only this time you really smell the smoke. Unpleasant, wood, plastic, electrical, chemical. There is a Buddha sitting and singing with tears running down his face. In front of him, three people face the mountain of ash and pray, hands folded, bow from waist, hands to the ground, kneel, forehead to the ground, turn palms up, stand, bring hands to prayer, repeat the whole thing. Then the teacher starts to laugh. The bowing continues. Finally, after maybe 15 minutes, they took a pause and I asked what they were doing. One of them, a Chinese woman, told me they were Buddhists and that they were bowing to the dead and praying they would go to heaven, which I guess is what she figured a Westerner would understand. She said they bow 108 times. They got ready to start again, and I asked if I could join them, and she said yes. It was the one thing I've done this whole time that seemed worthwhile. It felt like we were reaching out to the people who died, and to the towers themselves, and finally doing something for them, giving them comfort, assuring them that we know what happened, and we remember them with love, and sending them on their way. How long have I lived here and loved this place, yet never once touched my face to a New York City street? What we need is a real prayer for the dead. Not a movie theme, not "We Will Survive," but a resonant old ritual that gives form and voice to great pain. The trash basket was in front of me, the recycling truck came by, the police or firefighters were talking, the pedestrians were walking, trucks were allowed through the barrier, the smoke billowed on, and we stood up, hands in prayer, bowed, knelt down, touched our foreheads to the ashy sidewalk, stood up again and again and again, bowing to the smoke in the air and the ash on the ground that is so many people, so many things, so many events and memories, bowing, standing, taking the ash on our hands and foreheads and making it sacred, bowing, standing, mourning, accepting, releasing. My yoga school put a special message on their website calling for compassion for everybody and everything, not just the victims, but the terrorists, too. Not just the victims of this violence, but of violence everywhere. Not just these human victims, but all animals, too. The yoga position, I know, is basically that no life is separate from any other. So to speak of terrorists or victims, Arabs or Americans, humans or animals, is to impose a separation that does not exist in reality. But what I can't get past is the image, which was not an image, but a thing that really happened, of an airplane flying straight at my office window. This is what happened, and the people inside both the buildings and the planes saw it coming. They heard it, they saw it, and they knew the plane was headed at them, and they knew that within a few seconds they would be dead. all my philosophy, all my ideas of what is and what should be collapse like a stack of empty boxes when I consider this, which really happened for more than a minute or two. These people not only knew they were about to die, some of them probably even realized in the last moments of their existence what exactly was going on. Then they were atomized by a force I can't even conceive of. Here my imagining stops, along with my philosophy. I am not an enlightened being. I am a human being who practices yoga and tries to live right. But I haven't transcended any of the limits of my condition. And what I think are firm beliefs shred like a silk blouse when I am confronted with the thought of imminent, gigantic, roaring, annihilating chaos coming out of a clear blue sky on a fine September morning. So I don't know about this having compassion for the hijackers thing. I'm just not that good yet. I can find a certain understanding. Maybe it takes the same kind of inhuman nerve to pilot yourself into kingdom come as it does to drag your unwilling mind into enlightenment. Heroism and monstrosity standing side by side on opposite sides of the line, a line drawn in the ash.
Poet and performance artist Emily XYZ lives in New York City. After the break, we'll hear more radio diaries that have aired on this program since it began on September 17th. And as our show continues into the new year, we continue to look for new and interesting voices, your voices. Share yours with us. Send submissions for future radio diaries by email to special@wbur.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight, we're listening back to radio diaries that have aired on this program since it began shortly after September 11th and that have helped document this historic moment. In addition to airing the radio diaries that have been sent in by listeners like you, we often go out and speak to people around the country to listen to as many voices as we can as Americans process this rapidly changing world. Here are a few of those voices. At a senior center in Warwick, Rhode Island, Ed Greer. At the Brass Rail Tavern in Troutdale, Oregon, Ted Rippey. And at a quilting bee in Oneonta, Alabama, Joe Aikman.
Part of the G. Number 59.
I'm Ed Greer. I'm retired, been retired about 12 years, and I was chief of the Division of Food Protection for the state of Rhode Island. I saw the second plane hit the building, the second tower. I just, my heart sank, I guess. And I thought to myself, what a crazy world we live in. I remember Pearl Harbor. And I was of age eligible for service and signed up for the service immediately, as a lot of young men, 17 and 18 years of age, did at that time. And today, I just worry about my grandsons, who are of the age that are eligible for a service and wonder what the future is for our grandchildren and for our descendants to come. I just hope and pray that this world can straighten out and fly right. We've had such a good life in the past 50 years since the termination of the World War II, and things recovered, and we were more concerned with luxuries of our life. And those things are so insignificant when you think of what's happened in the world today. And SUVs are so unimportant, whether I own one or don't have one. There's so many people in the world that travel with their just by foot and wagons and oxen and so forth. I'm hoping that the various countries of the world will all work as a team to abolish this possibility of terrorism. That we'll all work. China and the Russia, who we've had conflict with and disagreements with over the past years. We all seem to be on the same team right now, and I hope and pray that it stays that way, and that the long-range effects of this event will actually bring the world closer together.
My name's Ted Rippey. I'm a traveling salesman, frozen bull semen to dairy farmers. And if you want to hurt us, come right out front and just hurt us, you know, take us on. Don't do it behind our backs. That's not right. So pretty much whatever they get, they get. I mean, I know we're big and strong and everything, but yeah, don't stab us in the back. And I don't want to kill innocent people, but yet, you know, what are you going to do? You can't just do nothing. So, I mean, I think it's almost like something you do that you don't want to do, like taking a test or, you know, reprimanding a child or something like that. I mean, you know you don't want to do it. It's not fun. But, I mean, you have to. You can't just do nothing. I don't know. I mean, in my mind, it's really complicated. I mean, they associate us with Israel. So, I mean, that whole thing's just messed up. But, I don't know. I think they're just using religion as an excuse, you know. Because I don't really believe any religion would condone that kind of a thing. I mean, I think we're a pretty open-minded country. I mean, but I don't... Sometimes, I mean, I guess they really hate us, and I don't really know why.
My name is Joe Aikman. Well, I think I'm more thankful for what I have and the fact that I can quilt in peace, and I'm not afraid that a bomb's going to drop on our quilter's cottage. I certainly regret what has happened, but I think that a little town has much more to be thankful for than the largest cities. And whereas it could happen in a little city, I hope it doesn't and pray that it doesn't. Well, I just feel very, very fortunate that it's no worse, and I hope the end of it is over for the ones that are doing such devastating things to innocent people. And perhaps they too can take up quilting and quit thinking about poisoning people and killing people. It's much safer to quilt than it is to do some of the things that's been done since 9/11.
The voices of Ed Greer, Ted Rippey, and Joe Aikman. On military bases around the country, men and women in the armed forces awaited word of their deployment. We heard from a Marine lieutenant in San Diego who asked to speak anonymously, and from his girlfriend, Emily Kaplan, about the prospect of her boyfriend being sent to fight in Afghanistan with as little as 6 hours' notice.
You've always got to be ready to deploy. You know, we're America's 911 force, so we're always ready to deploy. And that's the way we come, and that's our mission. You know, always ready to go, always ready to fight. As far as where you're going and when you're going, you may not know. Someone may have figured it out or see a pattern, but you're never really going to know. And that can be good and bad, you know. Right now, coming to Christmas time, as far as we know, we have Christmas coming to us. But, you know, afterward, you can be called at any time, or during Christmas, you can be called at any time. So Basically, when you sign the dotted line, you sign up to die for your country. You sign up to fight for your country. So you know better when you're swearing in and you're signing on that dotted line. And it's best to make sure that anybody who's going to be with you, you know, is in the know about that and knows your mission and the fact that at any time you can be called upon. And most do. But I think that's key in any relationship or in family being involved. You've got to let them know that, hey, at any time I can be called up. And I think most know that. And that's the hard part of being in the military.
My name is Emily Kaplan. I'm from Boston, Massachusetts.
I've never been with someone in the military before, but he made that very clear when we started dating that he was a Marine, and whatever that entailed was something I needed to accept. And up until recently, it's been easier to accept, but it's a tough pill to swallow because the reality is he could go and not come back, or he could go for such a long period of time and come back a different person. And I've accepted that fact, and I'm very proud of him. He chose a livelihood that is very difficult and honorable, and I support that.
It's very stressful because you have to mentally think that they could be going at any time, and you're trying to spend as much quality time with them as you can. But there's a lot of pressure there to try to fit in everything while at the same time relax and be supportive and not stress them out like you're walking a tightrope. But I'd rather do it than not be with them. It's been a hard year and a half. And the worst of it hasn't even started yet.
Emily Kaplan lives in San Diego, where her boyfriend's Marine unit is stationed. In early December, we heard from Salim Ali, an American of Pakistani origin, about the persistence and perils of memory. When Osama bin Laden pointed to history and charged Western oppression of the Muslim world in his video address that aired shortly after the attacks, Salim Ali felt that there are some histories best left in the past.
A few miles from Ground Zero in the Museum of Modern Art hangs Salvador Dali's enigmatic painting, The Persistence of Memory. Soon after the tragic events of recent months, I revisited the images of melting clocks that haunt this painting from the years between World War I and World War II. The images brought forth a dissonant realization that so much of the conflict which surrounds us now is steeped in history, or more consequentially, in the memory of past events. Just as the melting clocks depict a caricature of time, protagonists and antagonists in today's conflict are distorting repressed memories to promote their cause. As a Muslim of Pakistani origin, I am particularly troubled by the exploitation of our collective memory. Osama bin Laden's hate-filled speeches have urged Muslims to reflect on 80 years of subjugation since the demise of the Ottoman Caliphate. Not too long ago, Serbian nationalists referred back to the invasion of Balkan lands by the Caliphate in the 17th century to galvanize their armies. Even venerable writers such as the recent recipient of the Nobel Prize for Literature, V.S. Naipaul, has succumbed to an atavistic remembrance of pre-Muslim India and Malaya in his controversial book Beyond Belief. These examples illustrate that the phenomenon is clearly widespread and is reinforced by misplaced exhortations to learn from history, no matter how anachronistic the lessons may be. However, there is a difference between learning from history and being governed by the past. There is an unfortunate victim complex which many communities in America are developing that is fueled by the selective renewal of destructive memories. Despite its many failings, the American system has an admirable ability to learn and change. While some racial tensions continue, the remarkable progress in civil rights for African Americans following the nonviolent struggle of Dr. Martin Luther King is a worthy example in this regard. Those of us who live in America and have benefited from the enormous opportunities which this land has offered us are particularly concerned about the wave of anti-Americanism that is sweeping many Muslim countries. Muslims and our brethren in other communities must unite, but not over past grievances, but rather over a collective future as a global community. I am by no means advocating national amnesia of past injustices. Only a therapeutic reconciliation with the past and the timeless virtue of being able to disagree without being disagreeable.
Salim Ali lives in Mansfield, Massachusetts. Right before Christmas, a Massachusetts couple shared their holiday card with us. For Barbara Beck and Richard Bond, their usual message didn't seem sufficient after having lived through such a remarkable year.
Dear friends and family, this has been such a challenging and unusual year that recounting the usual family events, other than to say that we are all in good health, doesn't feel quite right. I stopped reading the funnies on September 11th and now read only A Nation Challenged in the New York Times. Over dinner, we talk about hubris and how it is that humans can believe in the superiority of their religion or culture over that of another's. But I was recently heartened by a newspaper photograph taken shortly after the fall of Kabul. The photograph showed four men on bicycles carrying large numbers of gossamer-colored balloons against that tan-gray, monochromatic background that has come to represent Afghanistan. The men were wearing expressions of great joy, as balloons had been forbidden by the Taliban. I thought that if the balloon vendors can return to Kabul, then there is hope indeed. Wishing you all well this holiday season, Barbara and Robert.
Barbara Beck and Richard Bond live in Watertown, Massachusetts. And there you have it. An Afghan emigre, a New York performance artist, an Oregon bull semen salesman, the San Diego girlfriend of a U.S. Marine, and the couple next door trying to make sense of a year that grew so suddenly hard and cold. Your voices, your questions and insights and view of the world are our touchstone here at Special Coverage. It's been a privilege to work and talk and search with you in this last year, and we look forward to more great conversations and encounters in the year ahead. There's so much to understand. A long time ago, on a farm in the middle of Illinois, my grandfather, an old Swede with a farmer's calloused hands and a dreamer's tender heart, used to tell me this when a task looked too hard, too complicated to accomplish. "Don't be afraid of it," he'd say, as we pulled a struggling ewe lamb to life or set out at dawn to cultivate a field that seemed overwhelmingly large. "Just get in close and work at it," he'd say. "You get in close enough to anything and you'll be surprised at the things you can do." We're taking that advice here, five nights a week, and running with it. With your help, we're getting in close to the issues, joys, and fears that turn our world. We're working for the depth of insight that makes the incomprehensible suddenly clear, the impossible suddenly possible. Together, we may be surprised at the things we can do. The program is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Nate DeMayo, Graham Griffith, Eileen Imada, Jim Moses, John Roberts, Jim Ross, Karen Schiffman, Keith Shields, and Tim Skoke. From WBUR Boston, this is Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Happy New Year.
This is WBUR.